National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the 11th in this series of 15 literary dialogues on democracy and the Bible, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren.
Mark, in looking into these questions of social forms and forces as they're envisaged in the democratic tradition and in the Bible, it strikes me that we could make a distinction, a preliminary distinction for purpose of discussion, that the democratic attitude is one that has evolved as a result of experience. It is, to use a word that we've frequently resorted to, the secular experience of mankind expressing itself in laws, in attitudes, in psychological patterns, whereas in the Bible it is not as a result of human experience that these laws have been laid down. They are uttered by the supreme power, by God himself, and are independent of what the people have experienced before. Would you take that as a working definition of the distinction between the two?
Yes, I would. I'm very familiar with the notion that morals are something that come somehow naturally to men through the experience of living generation by generation. Men, as it were, stumble upon precepts. They make them up out of their own experience, out of their own tribulations. I'm very familiar with that, and I dare say you are, too. And I have sometimes entertained the notion myself. But in the present context, it seems to me terribly important to realize that the story the Bible gives us is of a revelation. Certain things are said to men by God that men might not have ever been able to say to themselves. I don't know what the origin of morals is unless it is the revelation that we find scattered throughout the many books of the Bible which contain laws. Now, for instance, in Leviticus, Deuteronomy, but particularly Leviticus, and I'm thinking of the 19th chapter, you have God saying to his people, "Thou shalt not oppress thy neighbor, nor rob him." Now, maybe robbery is something that just common sense would suggest was not wise, but thou shalt not oppress thy neighbor. I'm not sure that men left to themselves wouldn't have oppressed one another.
Yes,
they still do.
You're touching the very core of the distinction I'm trying to establish. Society has discovered, let us say over the long run, over many centuries, that robbing your neighbor means the disintegration of society.
Yes.
It doesn't go further and say that oppressing your neighbor means the disintegration of society. You can imagine a society very strongly built and enduring where people do oppress their neighbors. Let's say not robbing, but lord it over them.
Yes.
In certain forms of society. Now, that is forbidden not on the ground of the stability of society as it has been investigated in human experience, but because it is an absolute that God has laid down.
That's
the difference you're trying to establish, I take it, between what we learn from experience and what is revelation, what is given to us as revealed law.
That word absolute was the word I was going to use. It isn't that it's prudentially better not to do these things. It is absolutely right to do them. Thou shalt not oppress thy neighbor, nor rob him. Then here's a law which has always interested me very deeply. The wages of a hired servant shall not abide with thee all night until the morning. That is to say, as soon as someone who has done work for you is finished with his work, you pay him. You do not wait until tomorrow. There's another verse somewhere, I've forgotten in what book, which says, if you have the money with you, don't tell
him to come tomorrow. That occurs in Proverbs. Say not to him, come tomorrow.
That's right. Pay him now. And
it's repeated again in Ecclesiasticus. It was very deeply ingrained. There seems to have been, we have to assume, a habit. And it probably still exists. But a man will say, oh, well, I'll pay him next week.
That's right.
It isn't convenient at the moment.
The man, as one
of the verses says, the poor man has set his heart on it, perhaps.
I don't know,
from experience that you must have had, which recalls the importance and the poignancy of this. I can't call it a law. It's an admonition. Be alert to your fellow man's feelings.
Yes, you don't know how much he needs it and how promptly he needs it. I'm in the habit with the boys who help me in the country, mowing my lawn and whatnot, of asking them every night when they're through whether they want their money today. Sometimes they don't. They say, no, I'd rather wait and have more later on. Next week it will be more. Very well. I consult their desires, but I always ask them, because once in a while they say, yes, I need it tonight. I have to go to town, I have to get something, and I was hoping you would say this. They might not have asked me themselves for the money.
Isn't it painful that from their experience with others, they should be in a position of saying, I was hoping that you would do it, instead of taking it for granted that you would?
Yes. All right, and there's that. And I think it's very touching and so highly specific, and again, something that I suppose it's wrong to assume would naturally and reasonably or rationally occur to every man. I think it's better to understand that it was revealed, that it was an inspired...
Well, there's nothing in legal or social law, as we've evolved it, which places you with the categoric imperative, pay the man the same evening.
That's right.
That emerges from the admonition to the human being to think of the other fellow. One of the consequences of loving your neighbor as yourself.
Yes. Now, here's another one in that series that we find in Leviticus 19. Thou shalt not curse the deaf, nor put a stumbling block before the blind. It's sort of grim, the picture that suggests that there were those who did that. Cursed the deaf as nuisances, stumbling in, because they couldn't hear them and so forth. And cursing and despising the blind, and even making fun of them by putting a stumbling block before them.
Impatience with the handicapped, with the incapacitated.
Yes, now here is a law which says thou must respect the handicapped. Thou must have pity, not merely have pity for them, but respect them and leave them their liberty. Here's another one, of course, that we've referred to before. In judgment, let's say in giving judgment as a judge, thou shalt not respect the person of the poor, nor favor the person of the mighty.
Yes, Mark, this is a very deep going thought. Do you know what it means to me that one automatically gives judgment in favor of the poor? It's robbing the poor of any moral standard. It's saying to the poor man, you don't have to think whether you're right or wrong. You have no moral problems at all. Now, this is one of the very distasteful consequences to me of what we call economic determinism, leftism, Marxism, that a man is not responsible for his actions. The economic law has reduced him to this position. He is a point where forces cross, and you don't blame him. But the funny thing is, they're very abusive about the rich, and very often with excellent justification.
With plenty of reason.
Oh, yes. But they can't bring themselves to be abusive about the poor when they're, I won't say abusive, but critical of them, which means the poor man is just a slob who has no moral judgment, has no moral problem. He's been ground down to the point where he is a thing. Mm-hmm. Now, this is an attitude that is not recognized in the Bible. No man is so oppressed or so poor that he hasn't got moral judgment. And he can be in the wrong, strange as it may sound, he can be in the wrong vis-a-vis a rich man.
Of course.
This is what and much more important than the legalistic aspect of this injunction is the fact the poor man has a soul.
That, exactly. You leave, in other words, the poor man his own dignity. and his own power to conceive of himself as in some measure responsible for himself. I was very much struck by a line I heard in a song just last night in a musical play here in New York. Everything I'm not, I owe to me. Isn't that a wonderful line?
Yeah, it's too good to be in a musical.
Oh, it's a very fine musical. No strings. Everything I'm not, I owe to me. And this was said, incidentally, by a person who was in very poor circumstances at the time, but he wasn't blaming anybody else. This might get us into a great many difficulties, except that I do want to hold on to the insight you had there, that what is finally meant by this injunction to favor neither the rich nor the poor, neither the poor nor the rich, because they are respectively rich and poor, poor and rich, is that you judge every person in terms of his own behavior and his own character.
Yes.
As if he had one.
This is a very tempting line of thought. Perhaps I'm going into digression. But to illustrate, when I come across a dispute between employers and employees, and I don't know the facts, instinctively on the side of the employee.
Yes, I tend to be too. Yes.
Now, my general reason is, he surely isn't as able as the other man to look after himself. But if the facts are presented, he may turn out to be in the wrong.
He could be wrong.
It's almost a moral law nowadays, don't cross a picket line. Mm-hmm. Well, if you don't know the facts, I suppose it's a sound admonition. But the facts may say to you, it's a wrong strike, it's a wildcat strike. It's a strike in which any number of factors could convince you that you should cross it. So that there is no automatic assurance of somebody being in the right because, or in the wrong for that matter, because of his civic status or his economic level.
Yes, that's the point. The word automatic is operative there. There should be no automatic response to any such thing. There are those, and I have sympathy with them, who are always, as they say, for the underdog, not knowing whether the person is truly an underdog in that situation or not. But they jump to the conclusion that he is. And, of course, one has the greatest sympathy with that tendency to be for the underdog. But, again, let it not be automatic. That's what this law is endeavoring to state.
All of these laws that you've just read out have in them implicit the dismissal of the automatic judgment of a situation.
That's right.
It's in this that they differ from a good deal from the spirit of the laws as evolved in democracy.
Then here's another one. Thou shalt not go up and down as a talebearer among thy people, neither shalt thou stand idly by the blood of thy neighbor.
Yes.
Now, of course, it's clear enough what is meant by talebearing. Thou shalt not be a gossip. Thou shalt not injure persons by talking behind their backs. Or saying, as Oscar Wilde used to say, things behind their backs that are perfectly true.
Yes.
But what does it mean? Neither shalt thou stand idly by the blood of thy neighbor.
Well, I read it in connection with the verse, with the section of the verse which precedes it. You have a verse, I think it's in Proverbs, or else it's in Ecclesiastes. What is it now? Mavet bechaim be'ad lasha. Death and life exist in a word. That you can deal out death and you can deal out life merely with a word. Mm-hmm. And you can shed the blood of your neighbor by uttering a word against him. And I judge that the context here has the same pattern of thought.
Yes, well, I had assumed that it might mean something like this, which is familiar to us all. Neither shalt thou ignore the injury, the injuries of others.
You can't.
A person accidentally injured someone, thou shalt not walk by him.
Yes, it's extended. I should think the commentators extend it into every field that you can't look at an injustice and remain indifferent. An injustice is being performed.
Yes, or at an injury.
But here, in this connection, the power of the word is so deeply ingrained in the consciousness of the biblical writers and commentators, you kill with a word.
Yes.
You remember, I think, in the Ballad of Reading Jail, is it? It talks about someone kills with a sword and another man kills you with a word. Well, this is the implication here, and no doubt Wilde got it from here. Words are terrible things that people can use. I wonder whether somebody has ever written a kind of history, or all sorts of histories are being written, judging the fate of mankind on the one hand as the sword has influenced, and on the other side as wicked words have influenced it.
Yeah.
Bad words said about somebody setting in motion a whole drama of human enmities. And we suffer more daily from people talking wickedly to us, saying mean things to us. A curious thing that suddenly occurs to me, how stupid people are who say bad things to you about somebody else. I have noticed in myself, and having questioned others, have found it in others, that we dislike as much as the person who said the bad thing about us, the person who tells us the bad thing that he said about us. And no sensible person will come and tell you, do you know what so-and-so said about you?
No.
Thinking it's doing you a favor and ingratiating himself with you, whereas he's doing you an evil and making an enemy of you.
Well, one way to realize how much words can hurt is to remember that we tend to go about day by day with the illusion that everybody loves us, that everybody thinks well
that's
of
the,
us. That's the only thing that supports us day by day.
The primal curse of the human being is that he thinks that he has to be loved. And that he merits love.
He must think so. No one can live unless he believes this.
That he is loved by somebody.
No, beloved by everybody.
I'm not aware.
I'm living, Mark.
I've lived a long time in the conviction that although some people love me, some people dislike me, and that the people who dislike me have just as much reason for disliking me as the others have for loving me, or as little.
Yes, I know, but I'm being perfectly honest here, and I think it's true for me and true for most people that we ride upon a wave of belief that, in general, we are
well thought of. In general?
Yes, in general. By the majority.
With this modification, I'm inclined to accept it.
Yeah, by the majority.
By the majority. Let us say this. I'll come to meet you, I'll bargain with you, and come to meet you halfway and say that we consider ourselves likable. Every man considers himself likable.
But
also has the illusion, if everybody was like me, there'd be no human problems.
Yes, but I'm only trying to throw light upon the deep pain that can be caused in us when we discover that someone has spoken ill of us. We didn't know that people talked that way about us. We talk that way about other people, and we hear it done about everybody else, but we assume that somehow or other we are exceptions.
We're immune.
Well, all right.
We carry a charm about with us, the old dream of leading the charmed life. But here's what I would next like to bring up, because it flows from these marvelous laws that we've just been rehearsing and commenting on.
Yes, and I have a few more.
Let me hear them, because then I'll say what I...
Now, the next one, of course, I think requires no commentary. It is maybe the most powerful of them all, but utterly simple. Thou shalt not hate thy brother in thy heart. That leaves you speechless. There's nothing to say about that.
Yes.
It's final and it's wonderful. And it's a law. I think that's revealed to us. That is, that's the thing we're told.
Yes. Isn't it remarkable that they have to supplement there's a statement, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself.
Yes.
You'd think that, having been said, this would be unnecessary, but it isn't.
It isn't.
You know, there's a very famous story, and I won't apologize for repeating it, though many of our listeners must know it, that Hillel, the great teacher, was once approached by a heathen who said that he wanted to learn the Torah, the Jewish law, while he stood on one leg, meaning in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
He'd gone, by the way, to a very severe teacher, reportedly severe, Shammai, with the same request, had been chased away. But Hillel said to him simply, do not do that to another which you wouldn't have him do to you.
Yes.
That is all the law. The rest is commentary.
Yes.
But he added, go and learn. Mm-hmm. People forget that he added, go and learn. Now you can spend all of your life very profitably learning as to what the implications of that law are. This is it. Don't bear a grudge. You'll say if somebody, and you said it's unnecessary to comment, I can't help it, don't bear a grudge. Very often, somebody that we're fond of, because we're fond, because we love that person, something that's angered us, we repress, and we bear the grudge. Now, there's another passage following closely on that, which says, thou shalt speak to thy brother, and in no wise keep silent with regard to
in other words, I shall not bear his sin upon thee.
That's it, yes.
In other words, speak out.
Yes.
Well, all right, it's all summed up in perhaps in the next verse. Thou shalt not take vengeance, and now I'm lecturing you, nor bear any grudge. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. It's all there. And, of course, here's the final sign and seal and signature beneath it all. I am the Lord. Ye shall keep my statutes. You see, once more, it is made clear that these sentences are spoken not by men to one another as cautionary and prudential and sensible remarks. They are handed down among those 10,000 commandments which followed the Ten Commandments. They are explications of the Ten Commandments. They are searchings through all of those basic laws, searchings into the ultimate meaning of the thing.
Well, look here, Mark. I'm going to run over.
Well, Maurice, I hope I didn't read too many laws.
No, there aren't. It's impossible to read too many. Always it brings me back to that deep reflection that I've read, picked up, learned, that you cannot learn the mystery, I might call it, of human behavior simply from observing the social effects and the producing statistics as to what is produced by this type or by that type. And I'd say the key phrase here is, for me, that you cannot adjust human beings by what is called a behavior pattern, setting up a behavior pattern. The phrase has become Kent nowadays. That's his behavior pattern. Mm-hmm. I want to give him another behavior pattern.
Yes.
People should not have behavior patterns. Yeah. A behavior pattern is an automatic thing. Supposing a man is taught, made into a behavior pattern, when you see an old lady crossing the road, run and help her. Now, this is the behavior pattern. You're not thinking at all. You've no relationship to it, but run and help her. Might happen there's an old lady who's very spry, doesn't want to be helped, is very much offended because somebody comes and helps her across the street. Well, take a look. If she's hesitant, go and help her. Think of the person. You'll get a behavior pattern. Always give charity. If a man is in the street begging, always give. Well, the tendency is, you know, when you pass somebody who's holding out a hat. Nevertheless, you must have a relationship to the man, and rightly or wrongly, exercise judgment in that particular case.
Well, in other words, think. You have kept using that word, and it's a very proper word. Think of each case. However, think of it in the light, and it's a very strong, powerful light, shed by these laws.
You know, this behavior pattern, I often observe it in a very trivial and sometimes rather irritating setting. Take off your hat in a private elevator when a lady enters. And sometimes the obstructive politeness of some of these men when the elevator is jammed is a beastly nuisance, but this is the behavior pattern. Take off your hat. The ladies object to it. Everybody is disgruntled by it, but this is the behavior pattern.
Everybody else has to stand aside so that you'll have room to do it.
And then you have three or four men clutching their hats to their bosoms and having them crushed and everybody uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But this is the behavior pattern. Now, they extend this from what I would call the moral, it's morale, it's manners. Even there, you mustn't have a behavior pattern. But the bad possible effect of using democracy and its measures as the source of laws for behavior is that it tends to the creation of behavior patterns, and largely because we must operate nowadays with statistical results rather than with individual attitudes.
Well, now, Maurice, let me get one thing clear. You talk about democracy, you did talk about democracy in that sentence that you just now spoke, as if it were a thing of almost fatal limitations, as if it were an unworthy thing, whereas we are finding it in the Bible,
yes.
Are we not?
Yes, that is, I speak of democracy in that way when democracy does not rest upon the Bible. It is going to degenerate in those countries where the Bible is ignored or fought, whatever there is of democracy...
will wither.
Will wither, and what you... It's not the state that'll wither, by the way. It's democracy that'll wither.
Yes.
But
Whereas at the very heart of the Bible itself, democracy
yes.
lives.
One of the loveliest things that I want to use now to supplement the laws that you rehearsed before is this one. It's also in Exodus. When thou dost lend thy neighbor any manner of loan... thou shalt not go into his house to fetch his pledge. Thou shalt stand without.
That's very nice.
Now, what a lovely thoughtfulness. He doesn't want you to see his poverty.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't want the children to see the man coming in to take something away.
Or maybe he doesn't.
The dignity of his home is not to be wounded by your intrusion into it. You've no right to go in and see, has he got any other things? How safe is it to lend him money? There's a transaction. Let him bring out what he's going to put in pledge with you.
Or it might be simply this, Maurice.
Where would democracy bring up a law like that?
Yes, it's
by itself, without the Bible behind it.
It's very subtle and fine. It might be this, too. The man in question, the debtor in question, might not want his family, particularly his children, to know that he has been a debtor.
Yes.
To know that he has been in debt to
anyone. All sorts of implications here. All sorts of sensitivities are touched upon subtly but very powerfully. And I say this does not... this comes from inspiration and not from debates on voting and on whether this shall be the law of the land or that shall be the law of the land.
Well, it's to me a very, very rich question, and it's a question that everybody in our world has had to settle for himself. Because the notion is so current that morality is good sense, that morality is the result of experience, as if experience were not an abstraction, too. I remember a man saying once to me, well, after all, I detest abstractions, and he meant also I detest revelations. He said, I go by experience. And I said, is the word experience not an abstraction?
Yes.
In a very high degree, I think it is one.
Well, these are matters which will take up our... next week's discussion, and we shall have, I imagine, a great many things to say about other forms of government and of human relations.
Just heard The Words We Live By, the 11th in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of democracy and the Bible. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
This is the NBC Radio Network.